The linen was untied, the wounds blotted clean, and we were married. There was a general air of relief and exhilaration on the way back down the footpath. It might have been any merry wedding party, albeit a small one, and one composed entirely of men, save the bride. We were nearly at the bottom when lack of food, the remnants of a hangover, and the general stresses of the day caught up with me. I came to, lying on damp leaves, my head in my new husband's lap. He put down the wet cloth with which he had been wiping my face.
That bad, was it?
He grinned down at me, but his eyes held an uncertain expression that rather touched me, in spite of everything. I smiled shakily back. It's not you, I assured him. It's just... I don't think I've had anything at all to eat since breakfast yesterday, and rather a lot to drink, I'm afraid. His mouth twitched.
So I heard. Well, that I can remedy. I've not a lot to offer a wife, as I said, but I do promise I'll keep you fed.
He smiled and shyly pushed a stray curl off my face with a forefinger. I started to sit up and grimaced at a slight burning in one wrist. I had forgotten that last bit of the ceremony. The cut had come open, no doubt as a result of the fall I had taken. I took the cloth from Jamie and wrapped it awkwardly around the wrist.
"I thought it might have been that made you faint," he said, watching. "I should have thought to warn you about it. I didn't realise you weren't expecting it until I saw your face."
"What was it exactly?" I asked, trying to tuck in the ends of the cloth.
"It's a bit pagan, but it's customary hereabouts to have a blood vow along with a regular marriage service. Some priests won't have it, but I don't suppose this one was likely to object to anything." He looked almost as scared as I felt, he said, smiling.
"A blood vow? What do the words mean?" Jamie took my right hand and gently tucked in the last end of the makeshift bandage.
"It rhymes, more or less, when you say it in English. It says, 'Ye are blood of my blood and bone of my bone. I give you my body, that we two might be one. I give you my spirit, till our life shall be done.'"
He shrugged.
"About the same as the regular vows, just a bit more, primitive."
I gazed down at my bound wrist. "Yes, you could say that." I glanced about. We were alone on the path, under an aspen tree. The round dead leaves lay on the ground, gleaming in the wet like rusted coins. It was very quiet, save for the occasional splat of water droplets falling from the trees.
"Where are the others? Did they go back to the inn?"
Jamie grimaced.
"No. I made them go away so I could tend you, but they'll be waiting for us just over there."
He gestured with his chin in the countryman's manner.
"They're no going to trust us alone till everything's official."
"Isn't it?" I said blankly. "We're married, aren't we?" He seemed embarrassed, turning away and elaborately brushing dead leaves from his kilt.
"Mm-hmm. Aye, we're married right enough. But it's no legally binding, you know, until it's been consummated."
A slow, fierce blush burned its way up from the lacy jabot.
"Mm-hmm,"
I said. "Let's go and find something to eat." Chapter 15. Revelations of the Bridal Chamber. At the inn, food was readily available in the form of a modest wedding feast, including wine, fresh bread, and roast beef. Dougal took me by the arm as I started for the stairs to freshen myself before eating.
"I want this marriage consummated with no uncertainty whatsoever," Dougal instructed me firmly in an undertone. "There's to be no question of it being a legal union, and no way open for annulment, or we're all risking our necks."
"Seems to me you're doing that anyway," I remarked crossly. "Mine especially." Dougal patted me firmly on the rump.
"Dinna you worry about that. You just do your part."
He looked me over critically, as though judging my capacity to perform my role adequately.
"I kent Jamie's father. If the lad's much like him, you'll have no trouble at all. Ah, Jamie, lad."
He hurried across the room to where Jamie had come in from stabling the horses. From the look on Jamie's face, he was getting his orders as well. How in the name of God did this happen? I asked myself some time later. 6 weeks ago, I had been innocently collecting wildflowers on a Scottish hill to take home to my husband. I was now shut in the room of a rural inn, awaiting a completely different husband, whom I scarcely knew, with firm orders to consummate a forced marriage at risk of my life and liberty. I sat on the bed, stiff and terrified in my borrowed finery. There was a faint noise as the heavy door of the room swung open, then shut. Jamie leaned against the door, watching me. The air of embarrassment between us deepened. It was Jamie who broke the silence finally.
"You didn't need to be afraid of me," he said softly. "I wasn't going to jump on you."
I laughed in spite of myself.
"Well, I didn't think you would."
In fact, I didn't think he would touch me until and unless I invited him to. The fact remained that I was going to have to invite him to do considerably more than that, and soon. I eyed him dubiously. I supposed it would be harder if I found him unattractive. In fact, the opposite was true. Still, I hadn't slept with any man but Frank in over 8 years. Not only that, this young man, by his own acknowledgement, was completely inexperienced. I had never deflowered anyone before. Even dismissing my objections to the whole arrangement, and considering matters from a completely practical standpoint, how on earth were we to start? At this rate, we would be still standing here, staring at each other, 3 or 4 days hence. I cleared my throat and patted the bed beside me. Would you like to sit down?
Aye.
He came across the room, moving like a big cat. Instead of sitting beside me, though, he pulled up a stool and sat down facing me. Somewhat tentatively, he reached out and took my hands between his own. They were large, blunt-fingered, and very warm, the backs lightly furred with reddish hairs. I felt a slight shock at the touch, and thought of an Old Testament passage. For Jacob's skin was smooth, while his brother Esau was a hairy man. Frank's hands were long and slender, nearly hairless and aristocratic-looking. I had always loved watching them as he lectured.
"Tell me about your husband," said Jamie,
as though he had been reading my mind. I almost jerked my hands away in shock. "What?"
"Look, you lass, we have 3 or 4 days together here. While I dinna pretend to know all there is to know, I've lived a good bit of my life on a farm, and unless people are very different from other animals, it isna going to take that long to do what we have to. We have a bit of time to talk and get over being scared of each other."
This blunt appraisal of our situation relaxed me a little bit. "Are you scared of me?"
He didn't look it.
Perhaps he was nervous, though. Even though he was no timid 16-year-old lad, this was the first time. He looked into my eyes and smiled.
"Aye, more scared than you, I expect. That's why I'm holding your hands, to keep my own from shaking."
I didn't believe this, but squeezed his hands tightly in appreciation. "It's a good idea. Feels a little easier to talk while we're touching. Why did you ask about my husband, though?" I wondered, a bit wildly, if he wanted me to tell him about my sex life with Frank, so as to know what I expected of him.
"Well, I knew you must be thinking of him. You could hardly not, under the circumstances. I do not want ye ever to feel as though ye cannot talk of him to me. Even though I'm your husband now, that feels very strange to say. It is nae right that you should forget him, or even try to. If you loved him, he must have been a good man. Yes, he was. My voice trembled, and Jamie stroked the backs of my hands with his thumbs.
Then I shall do my best to honour his spirit by serving his wife.
He raised my hands and kissed each one formally. I cleared my throat. That was a very gallant speech, Jamie.
He grinned suddenly. Aye, I made it up while Dougal was making toasts downstairs.
I took a deep breath. I have questions, I said. He looked down, hiding a smile.
I'd suppose you do, he agreed. I imagine you're entitled to a bit of curiosity under the circumstances. What is it you want to know?
He looked up suddenly, blue eyes bright with mischief in the lamplight.
Why, I'm a virgin yet.
I should say that was more or less your own business, I murmured. It seemed to be getting rather warm suddenly, and I pulled one hand free to grope for my handkerchief. As I did so, I felt something hard in the pocket of the gown. Oh, I forgot. I still have your ring. I drew it out and gave it back to him. It was a heavy gold circlet set with a cabochon ruby. Instead of replacing it on his finger, he opened his sporran to put it inside.
It was my father's wedding ring, he explained. I didn't wear it customarily, but I wished to do ye honour today by looking as well as I might.
He flushed slightly at this admission, and busied himself with refastening the sporran. You did do me great honour, I said, smiling in spite of myself. Adding a ruby ring to the blazing splendour of his costume was coals to Newcastle, but I was touched by the anxious thought behind it.
I'll get one that fits ye so soon as I may, he promised.
It's not important, I said, feeling slightly uncomfortable.
I meant, after all, to be gone soon.
I have one main question, I said, calling the meeting to order, if you don't mind telling me. Why did you agree to marry me?
Ah.
He let go of my hands and sat back a bit. He paused for a moment before answering, smoothing the woolen cloth over his thighs. I could see the long line of muscle taut under the drape of the heavy fabric.
Well, I would have missed talking to you for one thing, he said, smiling.
No, I mean it, I insisted. Why? He sobered then.
Before I tell you, Claire, there's the one thing I'd ask of you, he said slowly.
What's that?
Honesty.
I must have flinched uncomfortably, for he leaned forward earnestly, hands on his knees.
I know there are things you'd not wish to tell me, Claire. Perhaps things that you can't tell me.
You don't know just how right you are, I thought.
I'll not press you ever, or insist on knowing things that are your own concern, he said seriously.
He looked down at his hands, now pressed together, palm to palm.
There are things that I canna tell you, at least not yet, and I'll ask nothing of you that ye canna give me. But what I would ask of you, when you do tell me something, let it be the truth, and I'll promise ye the same. We have nothing now between us save respect, perhaps. And I think that respect has maybe room for secrets, but not for lies. Do you agree?
He spread his hands out, palms up, inviting me. I could see the dark line of the blood vow across his wrist. I placed my own hands lightly on his palms. Yes, I agree. I'll give you honesty. His fingers closed lightly about mine.
And I shall give you the same.
No. He drew a deep breath.
You asked why I wed you.
I am just the slightest bit curious, I said. He smiled, the wide mouth taking up the humour that lurked in his eyes.
Well, I can't say I blame you. I had several reasons. And in fact, there's one, maybe two, that I cannot tell you yet, though I will in time. The main reason, though, is the same reason you wed me, I imagine. To keep you safe from the hands of Jack Randall.
I shuddered a bit at the memory of the captain, and Jamie's hands tightened on mine.
"You are safe," he said firmly. "You have my name and my family, my clan, and, if necessary, the protection of my body as well. The man will no lay hands on ye again while I live."
"Thank you," I said. Looking at that strong, young, determined face with its broad cheekbones and solid jaw, I felt for the first time that this preposterous scheme of Dougal's might actually have been a reasonable suggestion. The protection of my body. The phrase struck with particular impact, looking at him. The resolute set of the wide shoulders and the memory of his graceful ferocity showing off at swordplay in the moonlight. He meant it, and young as he was, he knew what he meant, and bore the scars to prove it. He was no older than many of the pilots and the infantrymen I had nursed, and he knew as well as they the price of commitment. It was no romantic pledge he had made me, but the blunt promise to guard my safety at the cost of his own. I hoped only that I could offer him something in return. "That's most gallant of you," I said with absolute sincerity. "But was it worth, well, worth marriage?"
"It was," he said, nodding.
He smiled again, a little grimly this time.
"I've good reason to know the man, you ken. I wouldn't see a dog given into his keeping if I could prevent it, let alone a helpless woman."
"How flattering," I remarked wryly, and he laughed. He stood up and went to the table near the window. Someone, perhaps the landlady, had supplied a bouquet of wild flowers set in water in a whisky tumbler. Behind this stood two wine glasses and a bottle. Jamie poured out two glasses and came back, handing me one as he resumed his seat.
"Not quite so good as Colum's private stock," he said with a smile, "but none so bad either."
He raised his glass briefly.
"To Mrs. Fraser," he said softly,
and I felt a thump of panic again. I quelled it firmly and raised my own glass. "To honesty," I said, and we both drank.
"Well, that's one reason," I said, lowering my glass. "Are there others you can tell me?"
He studied his wine glass with some care.
"Perhaps it's just that I want to bid you."
He looked up abruptly.
"Did you think of that?"
If he meant to disconcert me, he was succeeding nicely, but I resolved not to show it.
"Well, do you?" I asked boldly. "If I'm being honest, yes, I do."
The blue eyes were steady over the rim of the glass.
"You wouldn't necessarily have had to marry me for that," I objected.
He appeared honestly scandalized.
"You do not think I would take you without offering you marriage?"
"Many men would," I said, amused at his innocence.
He sputtered a bit, at a momentary loss.
Then, regaining his composure, said with formal dignity,
"Perhaps I am pretentious in saying so, but I would like to think that I am not many men, and that I dinna necessarily place my behaviour at the lowest common denominator."
Rather touched by this speech, I assured him that I had so far found his behaviour both gallant and gentlemanly, and apologised for any doubt I might inadvertently have cast on his motives. On this precariously diplomatic note, we paused while he refilled our empty glasses. We sipped in silence for a time, both feeling a bit shy after the frankness of that last exchange. So apparently there was something I could offer him. I couldn't, in fairness, say the thought hadn't entered my mind, even before the absurd situation in which we found ourselves arose. He was a very engaging young man. And there had been that moment, right after my arrival at the castle, when he had held me on his lap, and... I tilted my wine glass back and drained the contents. I patted the bed beside me again. "Sit down here with me," I said. "And I cast about for some neutral topic of conversation to ease us over the awkwardness of close proximity. And tell me about your family. Where did you grow up? The bed sank noticeably under his weight, and I braced myself not to roll against him. He sat closely enough that the sleeve of his shirt brushed my arm. I let my hand lie open on my thigh, relaxed. He took it naturally as he sat, and we leaned against the wall, neither of us looking down, but as conscious of the link as though we had been welded together.
Well, now, where shall I start?
He put his rather large feet up on the stool and crossed them at the ankles. With some amusement, I recognised the Highlander settling back for a leisurely dissection of that tangle of family and clan relationships which forms the background of almost any event of significance in the Scottish Highlands. Frank and I had spent one evening in the village pub, enthralled by a conversation between two old codgers, in which the responsibility for the recent destruction of an ancient barn was traced back through the intricacies of a local feud dating, so far as I could tell, from about 1790. With the sort of minor shock to which I was becoming accustomed, I recognised that that particular feud, whose origins I had thought shrouded in the mists of time, hadn't yet begun. Suppressing the mental turmoil this realisation caused, I forced my attention to what Jamie was saying. My father was a Freezer, of course, a younger half-brother to the present Master of Lovett. My mother was a Mackenzie, though. You'll know that Dougal and Colum are my uncles. I nodded. The resemblance was clear enough, despite the difference in colouring. The broad cheekbones and long, straight, knife-edged nose were plainly a Mackenzie inheritance. Aye. Well, my mother was their sister, and there were two more sisters besides. My auntie Janet is dead, like my mother. But my auntie Jocasta married a cousin of Rupert's and lives up near the edge of Loch Island. Auntie Janet had six children, four boys and two girls. Auntie Jocasta has three, all girls. Dougal's got the four girls. Colum has little Hamish only, and my parents had me and my sister, who's named for my auntie Janet, but we called her Jenny always.
Rupert's a Mackenzie too? I asked, already struggling to keep everyone straight.
Aye, he's...
Jamie paused a moment, considering.
He's Dougal, Colum and Jocasta's first cousin, which makes him my second cousin. Rupert's father and my grandfather, Jacob, were brothers, along with...
Wait a minute! Don't let's go back any farther than we have to, or I shall be getting hopelessly muddled. We haven't even got to the Frasers yet, and I've already lost track of your cousins. He rubbed his chin, calculating.
Well, on the Fraser side it's a bit more complicated, because my grandfather Simon married three times, so my father had two sets of half-brothers and half-sisters. Let's leave it for now that I've six Fraser uncles and three aunts still living, and we'll leave out all the cousins from that lot.
Yes, let's. I leaned forward and poured another glass of wine for each of us. The clan territories of Mackenzie and Fraser, it turned out, adjoined each other for some distance along their inner borders, running side by side from the sea coast past the lower end of Loch Ness. This shared border, as borders tend to be, was an unmapped and most uncertain line, shifting to and fro in accordance with time, custom, and alliance. Along this border, at the southern end of the Fraser clan lands, lay the small estate of Broch Turoch, the property of Brian Fraser, Jamie's father.
It's a fairly rich bit of ground, and there's decent fishing and a good patch of forest for hunting. It maybe supports 60 crofts and the small village, Broch Morda it's called. Then there's the manor house, of course. That's modern, he said with some pride, and the old broch that we use now for the beasts and the grain. Dougal and Colum were not at all pleased to have their sister marrying a Fraser, and they insisted that she not be a tenant on Fraser land but live on a freehold. So Lallybroch, that's what the folk that live there call it, was deeded to my father. but there was a clause in the deed stating that the land was to pass to my mother, Ellen's issue, only. If she died without children, the land would go back to Lord Lover after my father's death, whether father had children by another wife or no. But he didn't remarry, and I am my mother's son, so Lallybroch's mine, for what that's worth.
I thought you were telling me yesterday that you didn't have any property.
I sipped the wine, finding it rather good.
It seemed to be getting better the more I drank of it.
I thought perhaps I'd better stop soon.
Jamie wagged his head from side to side.
Well, it belongs to me right enough. The thing is, though, it doesn't do me much good at present, as I can't go there.
He looked apologetic.
There's the minor matter of the price on my head, you see.
After his escape from Fort William, he had been taken to Dougal's house. Beanacht means blessed, he explained, to recover from his wounds and the consequent fever. From there he had gone to France, where he had spent 2 years fighting with the French army around the Spanish border.
"You spent 2 years in the French army and stayed a virgin?"
I blurted out incredulously. I had had a number of Frenchmen in my care, and I doubted very much that the Gallic attitude toward women had changed appreciably in 200 years. One corner of Jamie's mouth twitched, and he looked down at me sideways.
"If you'd seen the harlots that service the French army, Sassnach, you'd wonder I've the nerve even to touch a woman, let alone bed one."
I choked, spluttering wine and coughing until he was obliged to pound me on the back. I subsided, breathless and red-faced, and urged him to go on with his story. He had returned to Scotland a year or so ago, and spent 6 months alone or with a gang of broken men, men without clans, living hand-to-mouth in the forest or raiding cattle from the borderlands.
"And then someone hit me in the head with an axe or something of the sort," he said, shrugging. "And I've to take Dougal's word for what happened during the next 2 months, as I wasn't taking much notice of things myself."
Dougal had been on a nearby estate at the time of the attack. Summoned by Jamie's friends, he had somehow managed to transport his nephew to France.
"Why France?" I asked. "Surely it was taking a frightful risk to move you so far."
"More of a risk to leave me where I was. There were English patrols all over the district. We'd been fairly active thereabouts, you see, me and the lads. And I suppose Dougal didn't want them to find me lying senseless in some cotter's hut."
"Or in his own house?" I said, a little cynically.
"I imagine he'd have taken me there, but for two things," Jamie replied. "For one, he'd an English visitor at the time. For the second, he thought, from the look of me, I was going to die in any case, so he sent me to the abbey."
The Abbey of Sainte-Anne de Beaupré, on the French coast, was the domain, it seemed, of the erstwhile Alexander Fraser, now abbot of that sanctuary of learning and worship, one of Jamie's 6 Fraser uncles.
"He and Dougal do not get on particularly," Jamie explained, "but Dougal could see there was little to be done for me here, while if there was aught to help me, it might be found there."
And it was. Assisted by the monk's medical knowledge and his own strong constitution, Jamie had survived and gradually mended under the care of the Holy Brothers of St. Dominic.
"Once I was well again, I came back," he explained. "Dougal and his men met me at the coast, and we were headed for the Mackenzie lands when we, met with you."
"Captain Randall said you were stealing cattle," I said.
He smiled, undisturbed by the accusation.
"Well, Dougal isn't a man to overlook an opportunity of turning a bit of a profit," he observed. "We came on a nice bunch of beasts grazing in a field and no one about, so..."
He shrugged, with a fatalistic acceptance of the inevitabilities of life. Apparently, I had come upon the end of the confrontation between Dougal's men and Randall's dragoons. Spotting the English bearing down on them, Dougal had sent half his men around a thicket, driving the cattle before them, while the rest of the Scots had hidden among the saplings, ready to ambush the English as they came by.
Worked very well, too, Jamie said in approval. We popped out at them and rode straight through them, yelling. They took after us, of course, and we led them a canty chase uphill and through barns and over rocks and such, and all the while the rest of Dougal's men were making off over the border with the kine. We lost the lobster box then, and denned up at the cottage where I first saw ye, waiting for darkness to slip out.
I see, I said. Why did you come back to Scotland in the first place, though? I should have thought you'd be much safer in France.
He opened his mouth to reply, then reconsidered, sipping wine. Apparently I was getting near the edge of his own area of secrecy.
"Well, that's a long story, Sassenach," he said, avoiding the issue. "I'll tell you later. But for now, what about you? Will you tell me about your own family? If you feel you can, of course," he added hastily.
I thought for a moment, but there really seemed little risk in telling him about my parents and Uncle Lamb. There was, after all, some advantage to Uncle Lamb's choice of profession. A scholar of antiquities made as much, or as little, sense in the 18th century as in the 20th. So I told him, omitting only such minor details as automobiles and airplanes, and, of course, the war. As I talked, he listened intently, asking questions now and then, expressing sympathy at my parents' death, and interest in Uncle Lamb and his discoveries.
And then I met Frank. I finished up.
I paused, not sure how much more I could say without getting into dangerous territory. Luckily, Jamie saved me.
And you'd as soon not talk about him right now, he said, understandingly.
I nodded, wordless, my vision blurring a little. Jamie let go of the hand he had been holding, and putting an arm around me, pulled my head gently down on his shoulder.
"It's all right," he said, softly stroking my hair. "Are you tired, lass? Shall I leave you to your sleep?"
I was tempted for a moment to say yes, but I felt that that would be both unfair and cowardly. I cleared my throat and sat up, shaking my head. "No," I said, taking a deep breath. He smelled faintly of soap and wine. "I'm all right. Tell me
what games you used to play when you were a boy."
The room was furnished with a thick 12-hour candle, rings of dark wax marking the hours. We talked through three of the rings, only letting go of each other's hands to pour wine, or get up to visit the privy stool behind the curtain in the corner. Returning from one of these trips, Jamie yawned and stretched.
"It is awfully late," I said, getting up too.
"Maybe we should go to bed."
"All right," he said, rubbing the back of his neck. "To bed or to sleep?"
He cocked a quizzical eyebrow and the corner of his mouth twitched. In truth, I had been feeling so comfortable with him that I had almost forgotten why we were there. At his words, I suddenly felt a hollow panic.
"Well," I said faintly.
"Either way, you're no intending to sleep in your gown, are you?"
he asked in his usual practical manner. "Well, no, I suppose not." In fact, during the rush of events, I hadn't even thought about a sleeping garment, which I didn't possess in any case. I had been sleeping in my chemise, or nothing, depending on the weather. Jamie had nothing but the clothes he wore. He was plainly going to sleep in his shirt, or naked, a state of affairs which was likely to bring matters rapidly to a head.
"Well then, come here, and I'll help you with the laces and such."
His hands did, in fact, tremble briefly as he began to undress me. He lost some of his self-consciousness, though, in the struggle with the dozens of tiny hooks that attached the bodice.
"Ha!" he said, in triumph, as the last one came loose, and we laughed together.
"Now, let me do you," I said, deciding that there was no point in further delay. I reached up and unfastened his shirt.
sliding my hands inside and across his shoulders. I brought my palms slowly down across his chest, feeling the springy hair and the soft indentations around his nipples. He stood still, hardly breathing, as I knelt down to unbuckle the studded belt around his hips. "If it must be some time, it may as well be now," I thought, and deliberately ran my hands up the length of his thighs, hard and lean under his kilt. Though by this time I knew perfectly well what most Scotsmen wore beneath the kilt, nothing, it was still something of a shock to find only Jamie. He lifted me to my feet then, and bent his head to kiss me. It went on a long while, and his hands roamed downward, finding the fastening of my petticoat. It fell to the floor in a billow of starched flounces, leaving me in my chemise. "Where did you learn to kiss like that?" I said, a little breathless. He grinned and pulled me close again. "I said I was a virgin, not a monk," he said, kissing me again. "If I find I need guidance, I'll ask." He pressed me firmly to him, and I could feel that he was more than ready to get on with the business at hand. With some surprise, I realized that I was ready too. In fact, whether it was the result of the late hour, the wine, his own attractiveness, or simple deprivation, I wanted him quite badly. I pulled his shirt loose at the waist and ran my hands up over his chest, circling his nipples with my thumbs. They grew hard in a second, and he crushed me suddenly against his chest. "Oof," I said, struggling for breath. He let go, apologizing. "No, don't worry. Kiss me again." He did, this time slipping the straps of the chemise down over my shoulders. He drew back slightly, cupping my breasts and rubbing my nipples as I had done his. I fumbled with the buckle that held his kilt. His fingers guided mine, and the clasp sprang free. Suddenly he lifted me in his arms and sat down on the bed, holding me on his lap. He spoke a little hoarsely. "Tell me if I'm too rough, or tell me to stop altogether, if you wish. Any time until we are joined. I dinna think I can stop after that." In answer, I put my hands behind his neck and pulled him down on top of me. I guided him to the slippery cleft between my legs. "Holy God," said James Fraser, who never took the name of his lord in vain. "Don't stop now," I said. Lying together afterward, it seemed natural for him to cradle my head on his chest. We fitted well together, and most of our original constraint was gone, lost in shared excitement and the novelty of exploring each other. "Was it like you thought it would be?" I asked curiously. He chuckled, making a deep rumble under my ear.
"Almost. I'd thought... Nay, never mind."
"No, tell me. What did you think?"
"I'm not going to tell you. You'll laugh at me."
"I promise not to laugh. Tell me." He caressed my hair, smoothing the curls back from my ear.
"Oh, all right. I didn't realize that you did it face to face. I thought you must do it the back way, like horses, you know."
It was a struggle to keep my promise, but I didn't laugh.
"I know that sounds silly," he said defensively. "It's just... Well, you know how you get ideas in your head when you're young, and then somehow they just stick there."
"You've never seen people make love?"
I was surprised at this, having seen the Crofters' cottages where the whole family shared a single room. Granted that Jamie's family were not Crofters, still it must be the rare Scottish child who had never waked to find his elders coupling nearby. "Of course I have. But generally under the bedclothes, you know. I couldn't tell anything except the man was on top. That much I knew."
I noticed.
"Did I squash you?" he asked, a little anxiously.
Not much.
Really, though, is that what you thought?
I didn't laugh, but couldn't help grinning broadly. He turned slightly pink around the ears.
Aye. I saw a man take a woman plane, once, out in the open. But that... well, it was a rape, was what it was. And he took her from the back. It made some impression on me, and as I say, it's just the idea stuck.
He continued to hold me, using his horse-gentling techniques again. These gradually changed, though, to a more determined exploration.
"I want to ask you something," he said, running a hand down the length of my back.
"What's that?"
"Did you like it?" he said, a little shyly. "Yes, I did," I said, quite honestly.
"Oh, I thought you did. Though Mutter told me that women generally do not care for it, so I should finish as soon as I could."
"What would Mutter know about it?" I said indignantly. "The slower the better, as far as most women are concerned."
Jamie chuckled again.
"Well, you'd know better than Mutter. I had considerable good advice offered me on the subject last night from Mutter and Rupert and Ned. A good bit of it sounded very unlikely to me, though, so I thought I'd best use my own judgment."
"It hasn't led you wrong yet," I said,
curling one of his chest hairs around my finger.
"What other sage bits of advice did they give you?"
His skin was a ruddy gold in the candlelight. To my amusement, it grew still redder in embarrassment.
"I could no repeat most of it.
As I said, I think it's likely wrong anyway. I've seen a good many kinds of animals mate with each other, and most seem to manage it without any advice at all. I would suppose people could do the same."
I was privately entertained by the notion of someone picking up pointers on sexual technique from barnyard and forest, rather than locker rooms and dirty magazines.
"What kinds of animals have you seen mating?"
"Oh, all kinds. Our farm was near the forest, you see, and I spent a good deal of time there hunting or seeking cows as I'd got out and such like. I've seen horses and cows, of course, pigs, chickens, doves, dogs, cats, red deer, squirrels, rabbits, wild boar, oh, and once even a pair of snakes."
"Snakes?"
"Aye. Did you know that snakes have two cocks? Male snakes, I mean."
"No, I didn't."
"Are you sure about that?" "Aye, and both of them fought like this."
He spread his second and third fingers apart in illustration.
"That sounds terribly uncomfortable for the female snake," I said, giggling.
"Well, she appeared to be enjoying herself," said Jamie. "Near as I could tell, snakes haven't got much expression on their faces."
I buried my face in his chest, snorting with mirth. His pleasant musky smell mingled with the harsh scent of linen.
"Take off your shirt," I said, sitting up and pulling at the hem of the garment.
"Why?"
he asked, but sat up and obliged. I knelt in front of him, admiring his naked body.
"Because I want to look at you," I said.
He was beautifully made, with long, graceful bones and flat muscles that flowed smoothly from the curves of chest and shoulder to the slight concavities of belly and thigh. He raised his eyebrows.
"Well then, fair's fair. Take off yours then."
He reached out and helped me squirm out of the wrinkled chemise, pushing it down over my hips. Once it was off, he held me by the waist, studying me with intense interest. I grew almost embarrassed as he looked me over.
"Haven't you ever seen a naked woman before?" I asked.
"Aye, but not one so close."
His face broke into a broad grin.
"And not one that's mine."
He stroked my hips with both hands.
"You have good wide hips. You'd be a good breeder, I expect."
"What?"
I drew away indignantly, but he pulled me back and collapsed on the bed with me on top of him. He held me until I stopped struggling,
then raised me enough to meet his lips again.
I know once is enough to make it legal, but...
He paused shyly.
You want to do it again? Would you mind very much? I didn't laugh this time either, but I felt my ribs creak under the strain.
No, I said gravely. I wouldn't mind.
Are you hungry? I asked softly, some time later. Famished.
He bent his head to bite my breast softly, then looked up with a grin.
But I need food, too.
He rolled to the edge of the bed.
There's cold beef and bread in the kitchen, I expect, and likely wine as well. I'll go and bring us some supper.
No, don't you get up. I'll fetch it. I jumped off the bed and headed for the door, pulling a shawl over my shift against the chill of the corridor.
Wait, Claire, Jamie called. You'd better let me...
But I had already opened the door. My appearance at the door was greeted by a raucous cheer from some 15 men lounging around the fireplace of the main room below, drinking, eating, and tossing dice. I stood nonplussed on the balcony for a moment, 15 leering faces flickering out of the firelit shadows at me.
"Hey, lass," shouted Rupert, one of the loungers. "You're still able to walk. Isn't Jamie doing his duty by you, then?"
This sally was greeted with gales of laughter and a number of even cruder remarks regarding Jamie's prowess.
"If you've worn Jamie out already, I'll be happy to take his place," offered a short, dark-haired youth. "Nay, nay, he's no good, lass, take me," shouted another. "She'll lay none of ye, lads," yelled Murta, uproariously drunk. "After Jamie, she'll be needing something like this to satisfy her."
He waved a huge mutton bone overhead, causing the room to rot with laughter. I whirled back into the room, slammed the door, and stood with my back to it, glaring at Jamie, who lay naked on the bed, shaking with laughter.
"I tried to warn you," he said, gasping. "You should see your face." "Just what?" I hissed. "Are all those men doing out there?"
Jamie slid gracefully off our wedding couch and began rummaging on his knees through the pile of discarded clothing on the floor.
"Witnesses," he said briefly. "Dougal isn't taking any chances of this marriage being annulled."
He straightened with his kilt in his hands, grinning at me as he wrapped it around his loins.
"I'm afraid your reputation's compromised beyond repair, Sassenach."
He started shirtless for the door. "Don't go out there," I said in sudden panic. He turned to smile reassuringly, hand on the latch.
"Dinna worry, lass. If they're witnesses, they may as well have something to see. Besides, I'm no intending to starve for the next 3 days for fear of a wee bit of chaff."
He stepped out of the room to a chorus of bawdy applause, leaving the door slightly ajar. I could hear his progress toward the kitchen, marked by shouted congratulations and ribald questions and advice.
"How was your first time, Jamie? Did you bleed?"
shouted Rupert's easily recognised gravel-pit voice.
"Nay, but you will, you old bugger, if you didn't clapper your face," came Jamie's spiked tones in broad Scots reply.
Howls of delight greeted this sally, and the raillery continued, following Jamie down the hall to the kitchen and back up the stairs. I pushed open the door a crack to admit Jamie, face red as the fire below, and hands piled high with food and drink. He sidled in, followed by a final burst of hilarity from below. I choked it off with the decisive slam of the door and shot the bolt too.
"I brought enough. We'll no need to go out again for a bit,"
Jamie said, laying out dishes on the table, carefully not looking at me.
"Will you have a bite?"
I reached past him for the bottle of wine.
"Not just yet. What I need is a drink."
There was a powerful urgency in him that roused me to response despite his awkwardness. Not wanting to lecture, nor yet to highlight my own experience, I let him do what he would, only offering an occasional suggestion, such as that he might carry his weight on his elbows and not my chest. As yet too hungry,
and too clumsy for tenderness. Still, he made love with a sort of unflagging joy that made me think that male virginity might be a highly underrated commodity. He exhibited a concern for my safety, though, that I found at once endearing and irritating. Sometime in our third encounter, I arched tightly against him and cried out. He drew back at once, startled and apologetic. "I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't mean to hurt you."
"You didn't." I stretched languorously, feeling dreamily wonderful.
"Are you sure?" he said, inspecting me for damage. Suddenly it dawned on me that a few of the finer points had likely been left out of his hasty education at the hands of Murta and Rupert.
"Does it happen every time?"
he asked, fascinated, once I had enlightened him. I felt rather like the wife of Bath, or a Japanese geisha. I had never envisioned myself as an instructress in the arts of love, but I had to admit to myself that the role held certain attractions.
"No, not every time," I said, amused. "Only if the man is a good lover."
"Oh!" His ears turned faintly pink. I was slightly alarmed to see the look of frank interest being replaced with one of growing determination.
"Will you tell me what I should do next time?" he asked.
"You don't need to do anything special," I assured him. "Just go slowly and pay attention."
"Why wait, though? You're still ready."
He was surprised.
"You don't need to wait. I can't do it again right after."
"Well, women are different."
"Aye, I noticed," he muttered.
He circled my wrist with thumb and index finger.
"It's just, you're so small. I'm afraid I'm going to hurt you."
"You're not going to hurt me," I said impatiently. "And if you did, I wouldn't mind." Seeing puzzled incomprehension on his face, I decided to show him what I meant.
"What are you doing?"
he asked, shocked.
"Just what it looks like. Hold still."
After a few moments, I began to use my teeth, pressing progressively harder until he drew in his breath with a sharp hiss. I stopped.
"Did I hurt you?" I asked.
"Yes, a little."
He sounded half strangled.
"Do you want me to stop?"
"No."
I went on being deliberately rough until he suddenly convulsed with a groan that sounded as though I had torn his heart out by the roots. He lay back, quivering and breathing heavily. He muttered something in Gaelic, eyes closed.
"What did you say?"
"I said,"
he answered, opening his eyes,
"I thought my heart was going to burst."
I grinned, pleased with myself. "Oh, Murta and company didn't tell you about that, either."
"Aye, they did. That was one of the things I didn't believe."
I laughed. "In that case, maybe you'd better not tell me what else they told you. Do you see what I mean, though, about not minding if you're rough?"
"Aye."
He drew a deep breath and blew it out slowly.
"If I did that to you, would it feel the same?"
"Well, you know," I said slowly, "I don't really know." I had been doing my best to keep my thoughts of Frank at bay, feeling that there should really be no more than two people in a marriage bed, regardless of how they got there. Jamie was very different from Frank, both in body and mind, but there are, in fact, only a limited number of ways in which two bodies can meet. And we hadn't yet established that territory of intimacy in which the act of love takes on infinite variety. The echoes of the flesh were unavoidable, but there were a few territories still unexplored. Jamie's brows were tilted in an expression of mocking threat.
"Oh, so there's something you don't know. Well, we'll find out then, won't we? As soon as I've the strength for it."
He closed his eyes again.
"Next week sometime."
I woke in the hours before dawn, shivering and rigid with terror.
I couldn't recall the dream that woke me, but the abrupt plunge into reality was equally frightening. It had been possible to forget my situation for a time the night before, lost in the pleasures of newfound intimacy. Now I was alone, next to a sleeping stranger with whom my life was inextricably linked, adrift in a place filled with unseen threat. I must have made some sound of distress, for there was a sudden upheaval of bedclothes as the stranger in my bed vaulted to the floor with the heart-stopping suddenness of a pheasant rising underfoot. He came to rest in a crouch near the door of the chamber, barely visible in the pre-dawn light. Pausing to listen carefully at the door, he made a rapid inspection of the room, gliding soundlessly from door to window to bed. The angle of his arm told me that he held a weapon of some sort, though I couldn't see what it was in the darkness. Sitting down next to me, satisfied that all was secure, he slid the knife, or whatever it was, back into its hiding place above the headboard. "Are you all right?" he whispered. His fingers brushed my wet cheek. "Yes. I'm sorry to wake you. I had a nightmare." "What on earth?" I started to ask what it was that had made him spring so abruptly to the alert. A large, warm hand ran down my bare arm, interrupting my question. "No wonder. You're frozen." The hand urged me under the pile of quilts and into the warm space recently vacated. "My fault," he murmured. "I've taken all the quilts. I'm afraid I'm no accustomed yet to share a bed." He wrapped the quilts comfortably around us and lay back beside me. A moment later, he reached again to touch my face. "Is it me?" he asked quietly. "Can you not bear me?" I gave a short, hiccuping laugh, not quite a sob. "No, it isn't you." I reached out in the dark, groping for a hand to press reassuringly. My fingers met a tangle of quilts and warm flesh, but at last I found the hand I had been seeking. We lay side by side, looking up at the low, beamed ceiling. "What if I said I couldn't bear you?" I asked suddenly. "What on earth could you do?" The bed creaked as he shrugged.
"Tell Dougal you wanted an annulment on grounds of non-consummation, I suppose."
This time I laughed outright. "Non-consummation? With all those witnesses?" The room was growing light enough to see the smile on the face turned toward me.
"Aye, well, witnesses or no, it's only you and me that can say for sure, isn't it? And I'd rather be embarrassed than wed to someone that hated me."
I turned toward him. "I don't hate you."
"I don't hate you either. And there's many good marriages have started with less than that."
Gently, he turned me away from him and fitted himself to my back so we lay nested together. His hand cupped my breast, not in invitation or demand, but because it seemed to belong there.
"Don't be afraid," he whispered into my hair. "There's the two of us now."
I felt warm, soothed, and safe for the first time in many days. It was only as I drifted into sleep under the first rays of daylight that I remembered the knife above my head and wondered again, what threat would make a man sleep armed and watchful in his bridal chamber? Chapter 16. One Fine Day. The hard-won intimacy of the night seemed to have evaporated with the dew, and there was considerable constraint between us in the morning. After a mostly silent breakfast taken in our room, we climbed the small hillock behind the inn, exchanging rather strained politenesses from time to time. At the crest, I settled on a log to rest, while Jamie sat on the ground, back against a pine sapling a few feet away. Some bird was active in the bush behind me, a siskin, I supposed, or possibly a thrush. I listened to its dilatory rustlings, watched the small, fluffy clouds float by, and pondered the etiquette of the situation. The science was becoming really too heavy to bear when Jamie suddenly said,
"I hope,"
then stopped and blushed, though I rather felt it should be